by intelligent and civilized persons should have condoned such institutions? Are we to marry these thoughts with the ideas and principles and teachings of men like Pythagoras and Plato? Are we to assume that Plato was a charlatan or a stupid fool when he declared that when he stood in the presence of the great Hierophant of the Rites, he was as a little child knowing nothing? Was he completely overwhelmed merely by velvet and golden sandals? We cannot imagine that such is the case, nor can we imagine that the greatest and most creative minds of all time passed through these rites and afterwards enriched the world as no other group has ever enriched it. We have had many composers, but Pythagoras discovered the scale by which we compose. We have had many astronomers, but Ptolemy was the one who gave us the great concepts of mathematical patterning by which we developed the astronomical theory. We have used these things in many ways. We have had countless doctors through the ages, and for 2,000 years and more, they have taken their solemn obligation by the Hippocratic Oath, an oath dedicated to the gods, an oath written and conceived 400 years before the Christian era in a pagan sanctuary. These principles, these great ethical patterns, have come down to us from those who had received the mysteries. Obviously, then there has to be something, however we wish to regard it. And in terms of more rationalistic psychology, leaving the way for the moment many of the great and perhaps extravagant overtones of the old time, we are still face to face with the sober fact that these institutions were the great clinics of man's normalcy. They were the great hospitals of his soul. And indeed, these mysteries were the mothers of heroes, from whose womb came forth the teachers of the world. We need something. Perhaps we need the concept that was locked in these tremendous institutions, sanctified by the veneration of ages. This whole concept could be and must be revived in some way, not carrying with it something from the past, but moving into the future on the basis of the mystical experience made available to man through the unification and rededication of his knowledge, his vision, his wisdom, his hope, and his faith. Until some such motion is achieved, we are going to certainly lack foundations in eternity, foundations upon which we can build things that will survive a time and survive the selfishness of generations or the stupidities of centuries. There has to be this great basic thing. Now, many religions today, in modified form, have perpetuated rituals. Most of these rituals have been abridged, cut down, to favor the haste of man. But the difficulty with these rituals, as they are now given to us, as Pike points out, the difficulty is twofold. First, in the course of time, most of these rituals, through abridgment, through reforming, which is sometimes only casting things out of all form, through the reinterpretation by sects and various groups and creeds, the rituals have lost their ancient solidity. They've lost their ancient authority. They are now perpetuations of pretty patterns, which those performing do not understand and those observing do not comprehend. Thus, the tremendous vitality is simply lacking. Yet the principle does survive. And in the fact that it does come down to us, there is a hope that something more can be accomplished. Realizing that all of the arts and sciences flowed from this source, we perhaps can think of the words of Socrates to the effect that a man may outgrow his teacher, but he can never outgrow his natural respect and regard for one who has shown him the way. We may outgrow the past, but we do not outgrow the need to respect its accomplishments, even if we wish to move them into a larger framework. Thus, in the ritualistic part of life, we have need for restoring certain of these daily values. Now, what is the difference between a ritual and a commonplace activity? The principal difference seems to be that a ritual is purposed, and that in the attainment of its purpose, it makes use of discipline. The dancer, wishing to be a great artist, must pass through a long and trying period of discipline, becoming perfect in technique, in order that the technique shall no longer be visible. If it is visible, the perfection is not there. The great musician does not wish to be regarded as a magnificent technician. He wishes to possess the technique by means of which he can appear to be without technique, but so complete in his control of his instrument that it moves with him and obeys his every instinct and every impulse. Thus, it is not the purpose of great artistry to produce the evident artist, but to produce the total artist, evidenced only by the quality of achievement rather than the technical means by which it is accomplished. Ritual is then a disciplined use of natural instincts, natural impulses, in order that they may present a meaningful pattern for our own amazement or for the informing of others. In India and other countries, we have hand postures and body postures, and we also have sound formulas by means of which ancient symbolic rites are perpetuated. We have the mudras, the positions of the hands, the hand, finger, and body postures. We also have the mantras, the sacred groups of syllables, the garlands of sounds, by means of which the gods of the ancient Vedas like to be worshipped. These were disciplined formulas, and they all remind us of one thing, that worship is discipline. And that worship, to become meaningful, must be impelled by a regard great enough to make labor worthwhile. That the discipline must be voluntary. That it must be because the end is so noble and so important that any struggle to achieve it is as nothing. Therefore, in the concept of ancient ritual, the perfection of it was due to the incredible dedication of peoples to these sacred ceremonies, for which they prepared themselves by purification and by the most exacting disciplines of body control, even as great as that of yoga or the Vedantic systems. Everything had to be right because it was worship, and who worshipped poorly could not expect the gods to be attentive. In worship, therefore, this disciplined procedure gave us the religious dance. And all ritual consists of two great procedures. One is man's offering to the gods. It is that man recognizing his dependence, recognizing his need, his eternal and unchanging requirement. And this requirement was always the same, that the gods of ages must be nigh unto him. That only when he walked hand in hand with God could he walk surely and safely. Therefore, the great ritual was a presentation of his need, a statement of his dedication, a bringing to the altar of the best of himself and the first of all things in his life. And the second expression of the ritual was the revelation of the law in living. The revelation of the sovereignty of good, man's tremendous exaltation in the simple realization that he lived in a divinely regulated world, that it was his right and his privilege to walk with the gods, that they were present, that he need ask nothing for himself except that he might understand. There was no need for him to demand anything or plead for anything. It was a simple childlike thought or concept underlying it, the great faith in the presence of the parent and the great rejoicing that is born out of the realization that that faith is true. These were the two great things. Man quietly reaching out his hand to the invisible deity that governed him. And then, in his heart, having found that deity, performing the great rites of rejoicing, of exaltation, of crying forth the sheer joy of having found the faith and having felt within himself that he did live in the presence of an eternal light and that there could be no darkness. Thus the rituals primarily performed these functions. They represented man reaffirming his allegiance to God and then reaffirming God's perfect working in the universe and in his own life. These ritual pageantries, therefore, gradually, as Pike points out, took on Pythagorean definitions. They took on patterns of stars and spheres and ancient squares, patterns of circumambulation, patterns of lights and altars, patterns of directions and corners of the world, patterns all of them based upon this universal realization that the ritual was the actual representation of the machinery of the cosmos, that it was a revelation setting forth a living mechanism, not on paper nor in stone, the parts played by living persons who personified the elements, the principles, the laws, and the truths. And as you meditated upon these rites, a further thought came to mind, that these persons were not merely personifying laws for the sake of a ritual. These persons are themselves and must forever be personifications of the law. Every move we make is a ritual of the law, revealing either our wisdom of it or our ignorance of it. That every symbolic situation in a temple or sanctuary has its equivalent situation in the world. Therefore, the ritual is life, and life is the ritual. The small ritual locked within the 12 days of the Eleusinia was actually played out in the 80 years of human life. The ritual was therefore adjusted to life. It not only became symbolic of life, but it became symbolic of how to live life well. Who followed the ritual in his conduct found the gods. Who recognized that living was a lawful unfoldment of beauty. That the great laws of nature combined to form ethics, combined to form morality, combined to form beauty, will cause the individual to suddenly experience the possibility of a constant ritualistic procedure in which every action of life is forever performed with beauty. That the individual no longer breaks the ritualistic formula of his own conduct. We could not imagine in the midst of a high mass some petty, trivial thing breaking in and disrupting this sacred atmosphere. Nor can we really understand why man, himself a divine being, fashioned in the image of a creating power, endowed with the attributes of a spiritual universal integrity, should suddenly become selfish, narrow, bigoted, fanatical, that he should transform his benevolence into hatreds, jealousies, and envies, and in this way destroy that thing most necessary to himself, as Plotinus explains in his essay on the beautiful. Actually, a beautiful life is a perfect ritual. And all ritualistic living is living in beauty, living in rhythm and harmony, rather than in strange discords and broken chords and dissonances. The ritual then became the symbol of living. It became the symbol of gracious living. It pointed out that there is a divine way of doing everything. Just as there is a divine way that makes the corn to grow. Just as there is a divine way that brings the child into the world. Just as there is a divine way which meets sorrow with consolation. Everywhere in everything there is a divine way. That divine way is the sacred ritual, the sacred dance, the sacred arts and sciences with their perfect keynotes and keyboards. Thus, the divine way is the service of the beauty of inward motion. Instead of the individual stalking through life like some puppet on high boots, the individual moves graciously through life like the flowing robes of the Quan Chi Yin or the Lady of Mercy of Eastern Wisdom. Here these beautiful figures, ever gracious, their bodies and their robes flowing in perfect rhythm and harmony are symbolic of the simple way to live, the simple experience of continuing graciousness of conduct, all motion being a movement of beauty within man, beautiful because man moves from beauty, harsh if man moves from harshness. In this way, the ritual carries us into the great principle of initiation. All over the world, as Pike points out, the sanctuaries of the old rites have disappeared. In a few places, they linger on, in perhaps some instances with vigor, often with only a dwindling continuance of their ancient way. But gradually, out of all of this, has come forth the concept of the new sanctuary, the new house of initiation, the new temple of the mysteries, vaster and more splendid than the ancient temples of Eleusis and Samothrace. This is indeed that tremendous temple whose spanning arches are the clasped hands of comrades. The world is now the sanctuary. The world is now the house of initiation. Its floor is the earth, its ceiling is the sky. This great temple is where man, as observer and participant, observes from the cradle to the grave the tremendous passion play of human struggle. Here all ritual that has ever been, moving into the life of people, large and small, powerful and weak. Here we see the terror play of ancient times. Here we come to tragedies and comedies greater than those of Aristophanes or Sophocles. Here every day things are happening stranger than fiction or drama, for this great vaulted world is the new temple of the mysteries. And in this temple man comes at birth. He no longer has to wait to be 5 years old to receive the lesser mysteries. He receives them as soon as his eyes open and he begins to see the world in which he exists. But he goes through them by degrees. He cannot move more rapidly than the unfolding faculties of his consciousness and the strengthening structure of his body will permit. Thus he grows in family, in home, and in school. These are the grades of the mysteries. And finally, he comes to the maturing of his faculties. And he stands or sits as in some ancient amphitheater, watching the drama of the world unfold. It is brought to him not only in his own immediate environment, but by the great methods of communication. He can now see what is happening on the opposite side of the earth. He can journey to distant places. The world becomes small. The experiences of all men are available to him. He can live with many races and many kinds of people and worship in many temples. All these things are now his birthright. So he stands somewhere along this line of existence, like those who come back to the greater mysteries, which must be conferred when the priests of time are ready to accept him. In this sanctuary, then, of today, we see the great mystery drama. We see everything from the atomic bomb to interplanetary projected travel. We see all the inventions and the arts, but we have not the vision that was given to the ancient by his disciples. We do not see behind all this immense confusion the shadowy figures of gods standing, waiting, hoping, or enraged. We do not recognize that behind this drama is law. Law inevitable and irrefutable and immutable. We do not realize that all this phenomena suspends from one great noumenal cause. We do not find that spirit whose body nature is, and God the soul. We have not this experience. Therefore, we profane the mysteries as Cambyses robbed the temples and sanctuaries of ancient initiation. The heathen came in, the conqueror, the dictator, spoiled the temple of its treasures, scattered its priests, and forced strange and foreign gods upon the worshippers. This is what has more or less happened today. The great temple of our world has been plundered of its mysteries, plundered of its sublimity, and of its great mystical meaning by the rise of conquerors. Some who have wanted to conquer space, and others conquer science, and some conquer death, some conquer life. But the conqueror has taken the place of the worshipper. We live no longer to enrich the temple, but to pillage it of its treasures. And our earth is indeed laid waste by the ambitions of men. So our civilization, like some ruined sanctuary of the past, may become only a wrecked and shadowed thing if we continue in our present courses. However, the old mysteries also pointed out that man does with this ritual according to himself. What he brings to it, he receives from it. The measure with which he understands measures the way in which he will be understood, and vice versa. Thus, between modern man and the true vision of this thing, there is no more than those few steps that separated the marketplace of Athens from the sanctuary of the mysteries. There was only a few steps, and man must take those steps in some way. He must take them by restoring the soul of learning in himself. He must, by a subtle shift of his own perspective, suddenly find himself again in the temple. He is not in a factory. This world is not an institution. It is a sanctuary. It is not some strange prison or place of exile. It is not some terrible, pressing burden upon the spirit. It is a sanctuary, but we do not know it. And because in so many cases our creeds have become a bondage upon our spirits, we have forgotten that the universe is free, that it is a free place of free worship, that it is a place in which men find their inner life on a marketplace, on a street, in a forest, or in some anchorite's cave. It makes no difference where. But they are forever in the presence of the great ritual, the ritual that science examines in test tubes and under microscopes, the ritual that electronic science seeks with its mathematical formulas, all research projects, all these things are explorations by ritualistic means into ritualistic mysteries. All the rest is of a seeming. This is of the fact. And each scientist today pays homage to the ancient gods because he does not dare to perform an experiment which is contrary to law. The law holds him, and he cannot escape it. He knows if the law is broken, the experiment cannot succeed. He denies the lawmaker, but he cannot evade the law. If then, in this thinking, we find Pike's point of value, then by being taken into a house of initiation, into some sanctuary of rites, into some secret body of those bound by obligations, and there perceives the unfolding of some ritual of hoary antiquity, this individual may, perhaps, if he has a sheer genius in his spirit, and in this case the genius means a good daemon or a spiritual protector, perhaps a guardian angel, but if he has this spirit in himself, he suddenly finds in the unfolding of the temple ceremony the key to his total living. He becomes aware that he is simply being told that he has been given a new dimension of awareness, a new way of looking at things, something that changes patterns and situations just as truly and mysteriously and as wonderfully as Joseph Smith's eyeglasses are supposed to have done in the story of Mormonism. That by means of a new pair of glasses, he can read something that no one else has ever been able to read, at least not without the same pair of glasses or one their like. But actually, all you have to have in order to read the mystery, to read the strange characters traced by living nations, races, and persons upon the face of the earth, all that we need is the proper pair of glasses, the proper way of seeing. And the ritualistic procedure is an introduction to a new dimension of seeing. It is that which enables us to see not things, but through things. A kind of seeing which enables us to avoid the delusion of the evident. Something which gives to us this penetrating capacity to make veils become transparent because our own sight has gained a new penetrating power. The key is secret, is simple enough. It is so obvious that few find it. And that is this simple fact that when we observe under tutelage or under direction a certain ritual, and are told that it has a meaning, we are then stimulated to look for it. But when we turn away from this, and our scholars, our scientists, all our most progressive leaders, really progressive ones, tell us that this world also has a meaning, we are not inspired to seek it. We assume we see it already, that its meaning is given to us in terms of wars and taxes, earthquakes, pestilences, and local smog. That this is it, and that we are fortunate indeed if we can pass through our 80 years with a reasonable degree of comfort and make a somewhat dignified exit. That is all there is to it. It has never occurred to us to apply this key, the key to break through the obvious, the key by means of which men like Troynbee, for instance, have discovered that history is not merely a record, history is a motion. History is a dance. Nations dance their dance of death. Nations whirl themselves like some strange Muslim dervish into their own eternity. That all the things that we talk about are really great symbolic patterns. And that from these we can, if we have the insight, discover the whole mystery of existence. that instead of having to read thousands of books, we can open our eyes and watch the living book of nature, the living book of life, human nature, national policies. And there is not a day that goes by that the most deformed and defamed misrepresentation of news in our daily papers does not at the same time contain the secret of immortality for someone if he knows how to read it. It is the secret of the difference between life and death to read not the line nor between the line, but through the line into that part of universal pattern which this story reveals. And even though it has not been truly told, still some of the pattern is still there. Thus, by the observation of ritual, we become aware that we must never allow ourselves merely to accept. Not accept in the sense of intellectually acknowledging, this I see is enough. We are saved to a degree, as I said earlier, by the fact that we do not intellectualize ritual for the most part. We do find a receptivity and simply permit it to move us. We can do to a measure the same thing with life. But we must be sure that the thing that moves us is the true part, the true meaning of the rite, the true significance of that which is unfolding and occurring around us. I would say then that Pike's thinking, in bringing it down to more factual terms, is that the ancients took the world, made a miniature of it, and called it rite or ceremony. They then took the ceremony and taught their disciples to unfold it until they were able to rediscover the world from which the rite was taken. The ritual or ceremony was greatness captured in a miniature pageantry. And man, beholding the miniature pageantry, could move through it into the greatness for which it stood. Thus it was a two-way road. A road of bringing great things within the reach of man, and also of lifting man so that he was in the reach of great things. This double process means, and meant at that time, that in the ritual was combined what we call today religion, philosophy, and science. Under philosophy, we would have education. Under science, all experimental and phenomenal knowledge. And under religion, all estimation and apperception of causation, the divine metaphysics of the spheres. These things were there. And education, theoretically and factually, began by man being exposed to these models of the world. It is said the ancient in his wisdom made little models of great things. And these little models became the toys of the young. These little models of great things are the symbols within which man hid his knowledge. And they became the playthings of the young. For we as peoples, unaware of their sacredness, used for toys those laws and principles and those productions within which the secret of universal truth was concealed. So out of this all, this point, comes one kind of mood which we would like to try to capture for a moment. And that is this mood of persistent inquiry. This mood of man suddenly finding a new focusing of his sense of sight and hearing so that he could become aware of value under surface. As Maimonides said, beneath the body of the law is the soul of the law. Beneath the soul of the law is the spirit of the law. Paracelsus said that those who would understand the mysteries of nature must walk the book with their feet. In other words, they must search in this great world of pageantries as we see them and know them. Never disillusioned, never disappointed, never discouraged, but recognizing the play of the gods unfolding upon the great stage of human affairs. Someone asked Plato on one occasion what his profession was, and he replied, "I am by profession an observer." And man, to a great degree, finds this a useful point. The observer has tremendous advantages in many things. Apuleius, being initiated into the rites of Mithras, declares that he was the spectator of divine things. If we could capture in our consciousness that every moment when we open our eyes in the morning till we close them at night, we are spectators of divine things. If we could get this value, we would begin to know what education means. We would realize that behind everything that happens is a formula, that this formula must be understood, and that security, release from suffering, all the virtues of Buddha's Eightfold Path are available to the individual who becomes the spectator to divine things and knows it. He is no longer captured in this strange confusion that we commonly experience. He is never so deep in anything that he is not able to be quiet and watch the workings of the law. Thus, as a candidate seeing a drama unfold upon the stage, he may applaud it, he may admire it, but he must never forget that it is only a veiled representation of something else, that it is only a play, and that this play is based upon a great formula of laws. To recognize this could bring us back to a lawful religion. It could bring us back to a religion based upon man's recognition of the sublimity of the tremendous total existence in which we live, in which we no longer fear this existence, or merely respect it, or seek to exploit it, or even attempt to formularize it, but rather that in this whole existence we are capable of the immediate impact of a great spiritual identity, a tremendous divine principle, a principle to be met with veneration, a principle not remote, not some cruel and distant God, but a principle ever imminent, a principle immediate, as small as the smallest need, as great as the greatest problem. This complete, internal, ever-existing principle of value. If we could sense this, we could begin to dream of a universal religion, a religion that goes beyond stars and planets and everything of that nature, and really is represented by the great ritual of man's truth-seeking. In all the candidate rites of ancient mysteries, the candidate became the embodiment of the truth-seeker. He was the one for whom the mysteries existed. No candidate, no mysteries. The mysteries were not necessary to themselves. And in the great universe of value, there is no mystery. Mystery is only possible where the individual who seeks knowledge does not already know. Therefore, the mystery represents the quest of the ever-present, man desperately seeking something that he has already found and doesn't know it. The individual seeking in the furthermost for that which is already his in the innermost. So that the mystery of the truth seeker, making the perilous journey through the strange tests and trials of subterranean rites. This is only the story of the journey of the human consciousness toward the awareness of its own eternity. It is the removal from man of the blindness in his own eyes, for the darkness is not in the world, but it is in him. And if he can change his own perspective, the dark world gives way to a radiant and glorious sphere. Now, many individuals will say, like the rituals of old, that some of the rites were cruel and terrible, and that the candidate was exposed to terrific tests and trials which were more than flesh could bear, and that it might well happen that the candidate would not survive, but failing in the mysteries would never return again to the world that he had known. These symbolic statements were not so different from life. For every day we see people who seem to fail. We see persons who have gone a little way and can never return to the life that once they knew, yet they do not seem to be able to break through into that fuller life they need. We can also constantly visualize in our mind terrible monsters, ogres, dragons, and horrible fire-belching fiends guarding the way to peace. And we feel that this nation or that discovery or this individual is the adversary of all good, and therefore that we must, like some Siegfried of old, slay this dragon with the sword of our detachment. All this is ritual. Ritual thinking on the part of man. Ritual that has never realized that behind the mask of the monster is the kindly face of one of our own neighbors. It is hard for us to realize this. Harder still when we see this apparently kindly person doing what appears to be terrible things. And as far as we know and as he knows, they are terrible things. But behind all these terrible things, there must be a just law. If there is not this law, then all our faith is in vain. If there is not a truth stronger than evil, if there is not a reality more powerful than darkness and error, if there is not a sovereignty that is immutable at the root of everything, then all we struggle in vain. There is nothing. Only a little life rounded by a sleep. Therefore, our own innate consciousness must tell us that somewhere behind this veil of horrors which we see so often depicted in the rituals and the rites of old times, that there is a plan and a purpose. We are reminded, of course, in this of the great thought in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna explains to Arjuna why he must go forth and fight the good fight on the battlefield of life. Krishna explains to the young prince that actually birth and death, living, departing, hope, fear, hate, war, misery, pain, all of these things are like strange shadows that come and go but have no substance. That behind all of these things there is truth, supreme, inevitable. That death is not real and never can be. It is only a seeming that we have accepted as real because we have no glasses with which to see the truth. That wrong is an appearance, not a fact. That behind all injustice stands an eternal statue of justice that cannot be moved. And that everything we call injustice is so named because our own understanding is less than our need. That nothing happens, not a sparrow's fall, but it is within the law. And that this law is not a law of vengeance, but a law of life, a law of eternal good. It is up to us to find it. It is not up to us to shake our fists against the heavens. It is up to us to find the truth, to end this long candidate existence by taking the trials, passing through, and coming finally into the adytum of the temple, there to see our brothers who have gone before in their robes of blue and gold, waiting to receive us and to assure us and reassure us that we have wakened from a sleep of error into a light of truth. That all this horrible monstrosity which we have fashioned and perpetuated with our ignorance dies when ignorance dies in us. And that just as surely as we come through a valley of shadow, so surely we have within ourselves the capacity to live together in the light of peace. Between this sorry world and the golden time we look for is nothing but the bridge or interval of our own understanding. When we really know life to be the natural, spontaneous obedience to principle, man moving with the gods, then life and ritual become one. The symbol and the substance are no longer divided, and all this wonderful pageantry is revealed with its true purpose, that it must show the man the way.
and that this way was anciently taught in the mysteries, and that this way comes down to us now as ancient instruction applicable to the greater mystery of daily life. And if we use the ancient wisdom and apply it to the life of today, we shall find that we can successfully pass through the rituals and come in the end to that new birth in time by which we are born into the maturity of ourselves and return once more to the family of the enlightened, from which, as the hymn of the robe of glory tells us, we once departed. So man, descending into ignorance and rising therefrom again, his story is the ritual. And out of the ritual and the story, he gains the key to the conscious restoration and resurrection of himself. This is the concept behind Pike's understanding of ritual. And he believes that any presentation by means of which these facts can be driven home to us will not cause us necessarily to be ritual perfect or ceremony perfect, but will cause us to move to the recognition of the greater right, that the great mystery is the one that man masters through the use of wisdom as a key to unlock the unknown. And through virtue, through beauty, through grace, and through consciousness, he gains this wonderful sword, this Excalibur, this blade of the enlightened will, by means of which he can protect himself. And as the Knights of the Grail expressed it, the younger knights use the blade of this sword to fight dragons. But when the wiser knights face the great adversary, they reverse the blade, and holding up the cruciform hilt, discomfort the evil one with the symbol of eternal life, so that the sword no longer cuts, but becomes again the Crux Ansata, the key of life. And the will that no longer cuts and is reversed and held up as the symbol of consciousness becomes the master keyword, the lost word of the ritual. These facts and points lead on to many things, but perhaps we have captured in some small way the concept underlying Pike's desire that we should recognize the dignity and eternal significance of ritual. Thank you very kindly.